welcome to We Are History. I'm Angela Barnes.
And I'm John O'Farrell.
And John is still over there in the good old US of A.
I am. It's nine in the morning here, Angela. It's like doing the BBC radio van in your pyjamas, which I did do a few times.
I wonder if this episode would be less sort of sweary and fewer knob gags because it's so early in the morning. You'll feel a bit weird.
Maybe that's it. I'm just drinking tea. Yes, I'm just
because usually we're on the gin, aren't we?
That's right. Normally in the afternoons. Yeah.
So you've picked quite a relevant topic then for this week.
Yes.
John, considering where you are, because I'm not in the US of A, I should say. I'm in a very cold and rainy Brighton.
Even though I'm 3,000 miles away, Angela, I've been bought a VPN for my computer so I can watch British TV. And I've watched you on University Challenge smash it out of the park, Barnes. It was amazing.
How much easier did they make the questions than the normal? For anyone who doesn't know, I did University Challenge for Children in Need.
Yeah.
Representing Team BBC.
Even though you are a little bit ITV, Angela.
That was it. I think I said that on the programme, didn't I?
Did
that make the edit?
It did, yeah.
Yeah, because when I was little, one of my friends who were from a sort of, slightly nouveau riche family. You know, they thought they were it, but they weren't. Thought they were a bit better. And her mum said she wasn't sure about her coming to my house because we were a bit ITV.
And there you are, getting all the questions right on University Challenge for Team BBC. It was great.
Half of them, I got one wrong, John, and it's really bugging me. And I said A.A. Milne instead of Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, and
I buzzed in too early, interrupted.
And Angela, there was one question you didn't get, and it was Chicken Run. And it's like your mate.
Oh my God, I forgot that.
But.
Oh my God, I forgot that happened in the moment. I was like, oh, John O'Farrell's going to kill me.
But you've got some really hard ones.
But again, if people don't know, did you write the original?
I worked on the original. I didn't write it all. I wrote some stuff for the original Chicken Run, but I've just written Chicken Run 2, co-written with the original one.
Yeah.
So well done, Angela. I was very proud of you on behalf of We Are History.
Thank you.
Answering most of the questions, your BBC were bzz, Barnes, BBC.
Oh, it was so exciting when he says that. I love that bit. Like, oh, that's me.
I was on University Challenge with the Exeter sort of celebrity inverted commas team. And the first question I buzzed, and it was a history question, Angela, and I got it wrong.
I
interrupted.
Can you remember what it was?
It was, I'll tell you, because I did okay. I mean, you see where I was coming from. So Jeremy Paxman goes, which drink gets its name from the name of the British Prime Minister during the Great Reform Act? And I went, I know this, Earl Grey. And he goes, no, that's an incorrect interruption. A region of India that is, you know, Lapsang Soochong. So it was like, the answer was tea. And I buzzed super enthusiastically. Well, not only did I buzz super enthusiastically and get minus 5 points for our team, but I gave the answer to the other side because they just sat there and listened to the rest of the question and go, yeah, obviously it's tea, not Earl Grey, O'Farrell, you idiot. But we sat there on minus five for about 20 minutes. It was terrible.
Oh, that's annoying.
Yeah.
With the others just giving you the death
stare.
Yeah,
yeah. So my history was, you know, too enthusiastic or something.
Oh, mate. That's one thing I didn't know about University Challenge. Obviously, you know, they take it very seriously. It's a long-running thing. So they sort of take you into a room and debrief you on how it all works and everything. I didn't realise that you only got minus 5 points if you interrupted while they're still speaking.
Yes.
And then if you interrupt and get it wrong, you lose 5 points. And they said that's like their little sort of, that'll teach you for being rude and interrupting. But we didn't have Jeremy Paxman either. We had Kirsty Walk host the Children in Need one. Because I think I would have been intimidated if I'd been Paxman.
I said to him, can I phone a friend? That didn't go down very well. He went, no, you may not.
Just because he hasn't got any, he's jealous. Oh.
Anyway, back to this history.
I think we've digressed somewhat. So what are we talking about, John? Come on.
Well,
it's your topic.
A couple of weeks ago, we did Columbus. Because I'm still in America. Yesterday was Thanksgiving in America. And I was invited to my first ever family Thanksgiving. And, you know, I tried to take some traditional British food, like some, you know, doner kebabs or chicken tikka masala. but Thanksgiving, of course, celebrates commemorates when the Pilgrim Fathers sat down to eat dinner and be thankful for the harvest, you know, and they sat down with the Indians and said, by the way, we want the whole continent.
Yes, if you don't mind,
we'll have the whole lot. I think that's a Bill Bryson joke. Thank you, Bill.
So today we're not talking about that moment, are we? We're going a little bit more recently, and we're going to talk about something from later in the Native American story, which is the Indian occupation of Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay.
Yes.
And John, you chose this, so you're leading on it, but I don't think I knew anything about this.
That's fine. I don't think many people do, actually.
Before you brought it up.
No, well, many years, this might be because as a teenager, we went on holiday to America, and I went to Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, and it was a famous prison, Alcatraz, as people might
think. We went to Pontins. Sorry to say.
We went to California.
Very similar in many ways.
We went to California. Angela went to Pontins. It's, you know, they're very similar backgrounds. So I went.
Pontins, Alcatraz, not a million miles away.
So I went to Alcatraz when I was 17 as a tourist, Angela. I wasn't banged up there for running a drugs cartel. All the talk from the guide at Alcatraz when I was this teenager was all about the famous inmates, the Al Capone and, you know, Machine Gun Kelly. Then the guy mentioned as an aside, and then during the 18-month occupation by the Indians, and I was like, wait, what? There was an occupation of this prison island by the Indians. It's like, he didn't really talk about that at all, but I thought, well, that's interesting. And back then, in the 70s, it was a very recent history. The Indians had only left eight years earlier, and their graffiti was still visible on the water tower where they painted, "This is free Indian land." Weirdly, now, that graffiti has been repainted as part of the tourist attraction of Alcatraz. So I just thought, off the back of the Columbus episode, I wanted to do something about the American Indian politics, and I just think this is a fascinating story.
Well, we'll be the judge of that, John. But yeah, no, I think...
pressure's on now.
I think you're right. And, you know, it's quite a thing, isn't it? Like you say, the tour guide takes you around, and it was just an aside.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything more than that.
And when you say you haven't heard anything about it, I thought this was a bigger deal in the States than it was in England. But all the Americans I am... working with over here don't know anything about it either. So
right, so it's not just that it's not...
Yeah, I mean, I think Native American people would know about it, but I don't think mainstream American, you know, educated Americans particularly may not know about it. So, yeah.
Wow. And should we say something, John, before we go on about the nomenclature that we're using, about the because you're using the word Indian, and I know that there's some sort of debate about what should...
Yeah, I mean, back then...
How you should refer to American Indians, Native Americans,
yes,
et cetera.
Well, yeah, back then the protest was described as an Indian occupation, and then that is obviously historically wrong and perhaps insulting to call Indigenous people Indians. It's all Columbus's fault, Angela.
Yeah, still not accepted it as he's up in heaven saying, no, I'm not having it. I discovered a new route to India.
Exactly.
It's India. Yeah, they are Indians. Is.
So I thought that Native Americans was the correct term, but apparently that's declining in use. And they are comfortable with American Indians. It's considered acceptable.
Right, that's a sort of contemporary...
So they often say Indians themselves. So if we abbreviate American Indians to Indians sometimes, please forgive us.
So we'll try and say American Indians. Yeah. We might occasionally accidentally just say Indians, or sometimes Native Americans, because we might have been looking at books that say different things or whatever.
So a little background... Yeah, as I said in the Columbus episode, over 90%, I think 95% of the indigenous population of North America was wiped out in the first century after Columbus landed. There was murder, displacement from hunting grounds. Many, many more died from smallpox and influenza. Can you imagine? Well,
luckily, nothing like that could happen today, John, could it? Dying from something like flu.
A pandemic could never happen now. But they, of course, had none of the immunities that we developed over millennia.
Or vaccines, or any other systems to deal with
but
such things.
We did get syphilis off them, so there was that. Two-way trade.
So as the United States sort of spreads westwards,
yes,
the American Indians are displaced. They're persecuted, they're pushed into reservations, which is the worst land, the land that's hardest to farm on, to grow anything on, where there's no hunting to be had.
Yeah.
It's basically nothing to do there except... sink into poverty with no healthcare food or anything really to sustain a community.
Yeah, I mean, there was a sort of low level federal funding for this, so they might have had a cheap health center on the reservation, and they might have had some minimal schooling. But there was this boarding school policy that the American government had, which was to take children away from families and immerse them in European culture. So they were forbidden to speak their first languages or learn about their own culture. And that was all run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
And just as a little aside there, I mean, this is about in Canada at the moment. Obviously, they're having to have a lot of reckoning about their past with these boarding schools for native children, and yeah, lots of awful things coming out about those places right now. Yeah, so yeah, that's something that America and Canada, USA and Canada, are really having to face up to.
Yeah,
really,
absolutely.
What
yeah,
they did. So on the reservations, they got this a little bit of federal aid. They did have health centers and schools, but they were exempt from state laws. They were essentially a sovereign nation still, weren't they?
Sort
they were
of.
Essentially,
yeah.
But I think they were described as being wards with America as their guardian,
right,
rather
right.
than being equal sovereign
yes,
states.
Yes.
But they weren't Americans.
Right.
So they could follow their own traditions as much as their own situation would allow. But it was a sort of scandalous situation. You got the life expectancy was low, the poverty was high, alcoholism was rife. You know, you have people, yeah, with no means of employment, no industry, no.
It was 80-90% unemployment, yeah.
So we get to the 1940s, 1950s.
Yes.
And bearing in mind that, you know, American Indians, Native Americans have fought during both
World
Wars.
Absolutely.
For America.
Yeah, in large numbers.
So it was starting to be a bit embarrassing to the US government, the way that these people were being treated.
The way they lived,
And the way that they lived. So US government decided something must be done.
So they came up with this lovely sounding policy, which was called
the
Indian Termination Policy. Now, if I'm, Angela.
I'm sure that filled them with hope.
Angela, if I'm an American Indian, I'm not sure I like the sound of this. It's like, you think they might have gone to the trouble of giving it a more appealing name, the Indian Rights and Recognition Policy or something, you know.
Or,
hey, Indians, have some free money policy. But no, the Indian Termination.
We should say the termination doesn't apply to the Indians themselves.
No, but
it's to the sort of termination of this idea of the Indians having their own nationhood, isn't it?
Yes.
It's about the termination of a different statehood for them, so that they've essentially become Americans.
So, I mean, the white Americans in government believe this termination policy was a progressive and positive solution for the Indians. In their sort of, capitalist free market notion, the Indians could now work their way up in American society and all become millionaires owning tech companies.
Can't we all? And if you don't, you're just not working bloody hard enough.
It was about assimilating the Native Americans into mainstream society. Come and live in the cities where we can discriminate against you on a daily basis.
So it was for the first time, and it was making them full citizens, which I don't think I knew it had taken that long, to be honest, to the sort of 40s, 50s, for Native Americans to have the same rights and responsibilities as all other Americans.
Yes, but Angela.
But, yeah, it would also close the reservations, which means this federal funding that the reservations had towards things like healthcare and schools or whatever would end. And it meant that the Indians had to start paying tax, and they would have to get health insurance. And they basically, so they're now at the bottom of the pile of urban America. They're at the same level as the poorest people in society. They haven't been assimilated into society in a way that,
Orange County, California, and sipping cocktails and sitting by the pool, is it? No,
they're in shit housing, they're unemployed, and massively depressed.
Yes, and so, unemployment was around 70-80%. Infant mortality was double the average for whites. Life expectancy was 15 to 20 years shorter, which is pretty shocking. So a lot of these displaced American Indians ended up in the San Francisco area. They reckon there might have been 15,000, there might have been 40,000 Indians. There was no data on it. But that area, by the 60s, was becoming a highly politicized town. The 1960s was also seeing the rise of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war protests, of course. Plight of the American Indians not getting so noticed.
And it's quite interesting that, isn't it? Because again, like even here, we're taught about a little bit about the civil rights movement, not much, but we certainly know more about that movement and abolition of slavery and that movement than we do about the history of Native Americans.
Well, that's why I thought this was interesting to look at, because, they were the first Americans on the continent and they, had a terrible experience. But we don't get their history in the way that we get the history of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and Selma March. Perhaps because the civil rights movement was more successful and got more traction, than the Alcatraz occupation or whatever.
And maybe just visibly more brutal. Then, I'm not saying that the Native Americans weren't treated brutally, but maybe just visibly more, lynchings and...
Sure, and I think actually in terms of...
Ku Klux Klan and all of that was much more...
Much more high profile,
demonstrative and you know,
yeah, and I think,
visible.
And perhaps even in just pure numbers, there were more black people in America than there were Native Americans, because they tried to make slaves out of the Native Americans and it didn't really work. So they brought in millions of Africans, and it's we don't come out of this very well.
No, the white man is not the hero of this story, I think it's fair to say.
No.
In any way, shape or form.
So the American Indians, you know, were not getting noticed in the 60s. There was an Indian joke in the 1960s, which was, why were they spending all this money on the mission to put a white man on the moon and get him safely back again? They could have saved a fortune if they just put an Indian up there and told him to make his own way back. So that's you know, you've been great, thanks, good night, welcome to Indian.
I wasn't open with it, John, but all right.
but it shows you how they felt about the American government attitude to them. It's like they, you know,
yeah, they knew what
it was, sort of,
yeah,
it was a sort of satire about the termination policy. We'll dump you in the town, leave you to it, and that's no good. You know, you've got, if you're going to rip someone up from their homeland and their tribal sort of mutual support system, you can't just go, right, off you go, go and get a job. You know, you've got to...
Yeah, you've got to provide resources and
training and support. Yeah,
exactly.
So, Angela, in the middle of San Francisco Bay, Alcatraz Island.
Dun, dun, dun. Why is it called Alcatraz, John? What's that mean?
I've looked this up. It was named by the Spanish and it means pelican. Alcatraz means pelican. Perhaps the first Spanish who landed there installed a pelican crossing. No one knows.
Maybe that's it.
That'll be it. It's a rocky outcrop, no natural water source. It's 22 acres. It had become a sort of federal military base. Military prisoners were held there, and then later a high security prison.
Right. It was never inhabited. It was never, because it was not.
They think that really... they think the Native Americans might have camped there on fishing trips and things, but it was never a they don't think it was a home for tribal Indians or anything like that. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But it had famous prisoners, of course.
Well, yeah. So we had Al Capone, George Machine Gun Kelly, Birdman of Alcatraz, Robert Franklin Stroud.
Yes. Do you know what? I don't think he had any birds on Alcatraz. I read up about him because of this. And his bird escapades were at his previous prison. And because he was making so much money about it, or just becoming, getting so famous, they just took him, all his birds away, and dumped him on Alcatraz. So it was the no bird man of Alcatraz, sadly.
Poor bird-free.
Bird-free man of Alcatraz, Robert Stroud, yeah.
Bird-free, not free.
Yeah, no, yeah.
I'm desperately trying to get to a little pun there, but I'm very tired.
We'll do it.
It's not happening. It's not happening today.
So, but the prison was very expensive to run, because you had to take all the water out and everything, you know, and food, and cost much more per prisoner. So it was closed in 1963 by Robert Kennedy, and it was declared surplus federal land. And hundreds of suggestions were submitted for its redevelopment. They thought maybe we should build a great big statue on it, like the Statue of Liberty, so that when you sailed into San Francisco Harbor, you would see some, you know, some amazing statue. There was an idea of a private residential mansion, some Bond villain lair.
Where the top opens
and
a rocket shoots out. Brilliant.
Yeah, that was...
Oh, they missed the trick there,
didn't they? A nudist camp was suggested. No artist impressions on that submission, sadly. but one woman, Angela, had a better idea than all of these. And she was a Lakota Sioux activist by the name of Belva Cotia. And when she heard the words surplus federal land, well, what happens when you hear that? You think of the Treaty of Fort Laramie, don't you?
I do. 1868.
Everyone knows the Treaty of Fort Laramie, 1868. I mean, we all went, Angela and I went both straight there.
But is it just, it's a treaty, so 1868 treaty between what were then
the US government,
Native American nations and America, that said that any federal land that was declared surplus, that the Americans didn't claim, would be returned to the Sioux Nation, would be returned to the Native Americans. So Belva's like, well, if you don't want it, thanks very much. I think you'll find that's ours then.
Yeah, and she went down to the library and read out the got the terms of the treaty and read it all up. And in some office, and you know, it confirmed that this is what the law said from this treaty that everyone had forgotten about. But in some office somewhere, some civil servant was getting a bollocking. He's like, why did you use that phrase, idiot? Why did you call it surplus? It's like, didn't you think of the Treaty of Fort Laramie? No, I never heard of it. Neither have I. That's not the point.
So because of the wording they'd used, surplus land, that meant that they could lay claim to it.
Yes. So on March the 4th, 1964, a group of American Indians. Now, this isn't the occupation that this podcast is about. This is a previous sort of trip. So a group of American Indians not including Belva, obviously. Guys have taken it from here.
Yeah, it's all right, lady, you've had the idea. We'll take it from here.
We've got
this. Don't you worry. Don't you mess up your hair. You stay there. We've got this now.
So about 40 of them, more people, more reporters than Indians, it should be said. They went to land on the island. They offered the federal government 47 cents an acre for the island, which I thought was funny. Which is the same.
I should say that. Yeah. I mean, landing on the island wasn't an easy thing to do. Well, it's a bit. It reminded me a bit like of our Sealand episode. You know.
Yes.
Sort
yes.
of the trip to get there, and you know they couldn't take supplies on board. It was quite a difficult.
It's 5 miles.
Place to get
to. It's 5 miles out there. Yeah. So they offered 47 cents an acre for the island, which is the same that they had been offered for their reservations. So it was like a bit of like, oh, we're just offering you the same money. So that's less than $10 for the whole island. So the Indians that landed included Virgil Standing Elk, Garfield's Spotted Elk, and Richard Mackenzie.
Oh, come on, Richard.
Make a bit more effort, mate.
Hey, come on, Richard. The others sounded me, Richard Mackenzie.
Yeah, so this, as I say, this isn't the occupation that's the subject of this episode, but it's the first because this first occupation lasted 4 hours.
I mean, you say occupation, John, before I've done, you know, school trips that lasted longer than 4 hours. That's a visit, isn't it? They just go to the gift shop and then...
It wasn't really an occupation, guys. If you just go to the island 4 hours later, you come back in. It's like, how's your weekend, Angela? You know, occupied Brighton Pier.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's really occupied it. Well, I walked to the end, bought some chips, sat on a bench, took a selfie, went home.
Well done. Counts. What an occupation. I think they made a sort of statement.
It was a statement.
It was a statement.
And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like going to Brighton Pier. They couldn't get on Southern Rail. Mind you, actually getting on Southern Rail to Brighton.
That's probably harder. Let's
more tricky than getting a boat to Alcatraz, probably. But
but they achieved their aims.
They got some attention.
Yeah.
They got the headlines.
They got the headlines like Wacky Indians Invade the Rock. Crazy Redskins Claim Alcatraz. So not many hacks. In San Francisco, studying the fine print of the Treaty of Laramie or the Indian Relocation Act of 1956.
No.
So they began a legal claim to the island on the 27th of March, 1964. John's second birthday. I think we should make this clear.
Little John.
Little two-year-old John. He's like, what's why? My mum and dad get me things. My two-year-old birthday. But they're going, wait, what's this? The American Indians have made a claim? This is the main thing we're thinking about. Of course, the claim wasn't taken seriously and the island remained unused, and debate continued about, you know, what we should do with this rocky island in the middle of the bay. Fast forward 5 years to October 1969, and there's a terrible fire at the San Francisco Indian Center, which was devastating for the local Indian population because of its importance as their meeting place, their cultural center.
It's like a cultural center.
Yeah.
Where they can gather and,
education, legal support, social interaction. Because of this, the Indians were running out of patience, and one of their leaders, Adam Fortunate Eagle, planned an occupation on the 9th of November.
Oh, that's my birthday, John.
This story is really all about us.
Isn't it?
This is all about us, this podcast.
I was, minus seven?
Oh, you weren't even born.
The 9th of November.
It's a historic day.
Schicksaltag is what the Germans call it, which means day of fate.
Well, there we are.
Because so many sort of, particularly in Germany
Berlin
so many
Wall,
things have happened.
Kristallnacht.
Berlin Wall, Kristallnacht, a couple of nuclear near misses.
Hitler's Munich putsch, I think, was on the 9th of November. Yep. And the birth of Angela Barnes, I think, is the thing.
The birth of Angela Barnes, which I think you'll find.
Yeah, it's right up there.
Right up there, yeah.
It's like, because that's when the Berlin Wall came down, that I have a piece of at home. That you've always acknowledged.
Oh, John. Yes, of course you do, John. Of course it's a genuine piece of Berlin Wall. I feel bad now taking the mickey out of you for that because I can't remember if I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but for our wedding, I bought Matt, my husband, cufflinks that were made of bits of Berlin Wall.
Sure they were. I'm sure those
so
weren't
now
real.
I'm just like, oh.
Mine was from the time.
Mine are definitely real. They got bits of graffiti on and everything.
So,
do you know what we've done here, John,
yes.
Don't you? We've taken a story about Native America. We are making it about us.
I think that's fair enough.
That is white European thing.
We're satirising the white colonials. So on that fateful Sunday, a group of 75 activists gathered on the harbour in San Francisco, waiting for the 5 boats that had been arranged to take them to the island, where they would sail to this abandoned rock and claim it by right of discovery. They'd say they discovered Alcatraz, which is like nice and satirical.
In the way that Columbus discovered
exactly their homeland,
America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on the dock, they're on the dock of the Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco in front of the cameras. Richard Oakes is their sort of effective leader. He's a sort of, you know, very articulate young activist, and the press sort of made him the leader, really. He made this proclamation, which is rather poetic. And it said, the first land that people would see as they sailed through the Golden Gate Bridge would be free Indian land, to represent the whole continent that was once the free home of the Indian people. But now we're just going to be stuck on this little rock on the west coast. That'll be the only bit that's free Indian land. So it's quite poetic, I think.
It's very sort of, yeah, an evocative and sort of emotional proclamation, wasn't it? That might be a good place to take a little break there. And then we'll find out what happens next after these words. I was going to save these words from our sponsors, but we don't know who they are. We might not want to associate with them. So from these words, from some random adverts that are going to come up that may or may not be something that we would affiliate ourselves
Excellent.
With.
We have no idea.
There we go.
Okay.
I think that was slickly done, wasn't it?
Very good.
Hello, welcome back to We Are History Pod, where we are talking about the Indian occupation of Alcatraz in 1969.
Yeah.
So we left this large crowd of Native Americans by the quayside at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco on a cold November Sunday, waiting for 5 boats to turn up to take them to Alcatraz.
And Angela, in the tradition of progressive protests down the centuries, there was some sort of cock-up and the boats never turned up.
Oh no. Who didn't order the boat? Who was supposed to order the boat?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they went to the wrong place. We've got the TV cameras.
Food. We've got the tea bags. We've got the presser here.
Basically, all of history is like this, Angela. You know, they never show it in the movies, do they? It's like people standing around arguing about who made the rubbish arrangements. But so it was the wrong day or it was the wrong time or something. So Adam Fortunate Eagle managed to persuade a local owner of a 2-masted yacht, it said in the... in the notes, I said, "Oh, 2-masted yacht. That's yacht. That's technically a ketch. That's what John O'Farrell goes.
Oh, John's a boatman.
Oh, no, it's not a yacht. You see, a yacht.
Oh, I think he'll find that's a ketch.
No one stood up and said this point at the time, which I think is probably just as well.
My favourite people on Twitter, John, are the ones who start with their tweets with, actually, I think you'll find.
Well, actually.
I think you'll find.
It's a ketch. So luckily John wasn't there. But so this guy, this owner of this 2-masted yacht, he said, "Oh, well, I'll take you there, but I can't dock at Alcatraz. I'll just sail around it." So they got really close to this island, and then 5 of the young Indians jumped over the side and swam to Alcatraz. This is November, and San Francisco is not a hot place.
Oh my gosh!
And they claimed it for the Indians of all tribes.
So that's quite something as well, isn't it, to have this kind of umbrella?
Yes, this was a new thing to say the Indians of all tribes, and there's been very little pan-Indian activism in America, because the loss of each reservation happened to one tribe. Do you know what I mean? So a year before, I think there'd been some sort of pan-Indian organization, but that wasn't connected with this occupation. These guys were young hotheads. They'd actually timed their occupation for when their elders were away at an education conference, because they wanted to.
They didn't want to be stopped.
They didn't want to be dissuaded by the older ones. And you know, sometimes you just need a few. It's a bit like the Bristol bus boycott. Sometimes you need a few young sort of hotheads to go, "Oh, sod it. We're just going to do it." And get
who aren't going to be too careful, who aren't going to be too worried about consequences, who are just going to go sod it, worry about it later.
Because the tradition of Indian sort of activism had always been turn the other cheek, patience, non-confrontation, believe it or not. And that wasn't getting them anywhere. So these younger people are like, sod that. We're jumping over.
And of course, because they've jumped from a boat and swum to Alcatraz, they're not exactly properly equipped to start an occupation. So they've got no tents, they've got no food, they've got no cooking equipment, not even a Swiss Army knife.
No Swiss Army knife.
Nothing. So, you know, in the morning when the Coast Guard comes and says, "Oi, get off this island," they're sat there shivering in their wet clothes, going, "Oh, do we have to?"
If you insist.
If you insist, we'll get off.
Yeah.
They couldn't stay, could they, as much as they...
No.
They didn't have any supplies or anything.
No, they were freezing cold. I mean, they swum in their wet clothes in the bay in November. They weren't even writing an article for The Guardian about cold water swimming. That's... but they got a bit more of those.
Could they not see the benefit, John?
I know.
It helps in circulation.
The wellness and me and my personal...
mindfulness and other buzzwords.
Yeah, they didn't do any of that. I missed a trick, if I'm honest, Angela. I mean, so they got a bit more organised. And then so a couple of weeks later, I think on the 20th of November, 89 American Indians, including 30 women, 6 children, set out to occupy the island properly.
So this time they've got supplies.
They've got it all worked out. But the Coast Guard are more onto this now. So they set up these blockade with their big, powerful boats compared to the little Indian boats. They prevented most of them getting through. So there's all this sort of manoeuvring and boats trying to cut each other up and with all these Indians trying to get... Wow. Must have been quite a scene in the bay. But 14 of them did manage to get through. And on the island itself, there was just a lone caretaker called Glenn Dobson, who was living on the island, supposed to be looking after it. And he sends out a radio message going, "Mayday, mayday, the Indians have landed."
Apparently, the thing I looked at, he claimed to them
that's
that he
right.
was like an eighth
Cherokee
Native American. Yeah, Cherokee, that's right. I can't remember which tribe.
Yeah. It's like, well, that's sort of an annoying thing to say, isn't it? Oh, I'm actually a bit Indian myself.
Speaking as someone, John, who herself... is about an eighth Native American.
Are you really? That's amazing, an eighth.
I am,
the other side, a different rock, Angela, on the other side of the land.
A different rock on the,
Welcome to the rock.
Yay! Comfortable wave, you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, it's good, So, as I said, these were the...
We couldn't do a whole podcast without me mentioning Newfoundland.
It's not going to happen.
Never going to happen.
So, as I say, these were the younger activists, and they timed their occupation with their elders being away. They claimed the island on behalf of the Indians of all tribes, like we said, because most of the Indian activism had been sort of tribe by tribe. Next day, more Indians landed and others brought food and other supplies by canoe. Because the Coast Guard was blocking the sort of the dock at Alcatraz, they had to go around the back and haul all their stuff up a rocky cliff face.
So you didn't have a nice place to land and bring it all ashore.
No, I mean Alcatraz has that, but the Coast Guard had blocked that off.
Being blocked by the,
But they declared this island free Indian land. They weren't stealing it. They prepared to buy it off the US government for some beads and cloth.
Oh, burn!
Mic drop!
Oh.
And then, they created a Bureau of Caucasian Affairs. Oh, burn again!
Oh, yes.
Double burn!
Love it.
They were smashing
it. They are smashing this.
They're knocking
this
it out of the park.
It was brilliant, and they obviously had good PR people. Do you know what I mean? They were their own good PR. They said, it's going to be perfect for an Indian homeland because it's got no water. Nothing can grow there. There's no wildlife. There's no means of sustaining a living. And, you know, that's what we used to from our reservations. So it's perfect.
Excellent.
It's obvious.
Yeah.
And there was obviously something symbolic about the island having a prison.
Yeah,
in it,
exactly.
You know, right on the opposite edge of the continent from where the Europeans had landed.
Yeah.
And the Indians had been pushed further and further west until all that's left of them was a rocky prison island on the west coast.
Exactly.
What a symbol.
It was
what
a fantastic symbol. It was
metaphor.
Really poetic. It's almost politics as performance art, really. It's like a sort of, as you say, symbolic protest. You obviously couldn't sustain a life on Alcatraz, but they were just going to live here and make their point. And they were actually demanding, they wanted an Indian cultural centre and a university for Indians and for the land to actually be granted to them. And so this is November, and on Thanksgiving Day, hundreds of supporters made their way to Alcatraz and celebrate their occupation. There were 400 on the island, and San Francisco restaurant supplied food for everyone, and it was getting loads of publicity, and everyone's going, good on you guys, this is amazing.
And we should say, there's a backdrop of, you know, Vietnam and lots of other kind of, we said before, civil rights protests and other things, you know, that are going on at the time. There's an activism in the air, isn't
absolutely.
There?
Absolutely.
Particularly in California and San Francisco.
Absolutely.
And so they're getting the support from those people.
And the Longshoremen's Union on the seafront at San Francisco supported them. And there was a pier on the mainland given over to supplying them, and people could make donations. And, you know, the occupation captured people's imagination.
Yeah, you have Radio Free Alcatraz.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, they were
broadcasting and,
yeah, and lots of celebrities visited to show their support. Jane Fonda, Anthony Quinn, Marlon Brando, you know.
He's a consistent supporter of Native American rights.
He was, yeah.
When he won the Oscar in 1973, he sent up Native American actress Sashine Littlefeather to reject the award in protest on his behalf.
Yes.
So he's been a sort of consistent ally for Native American rights. Although she later said that destroyed her own acting career. Because I suppose, you're then the symbol of someone else's career, aren't you?
Exactly.
Sort of what he actually did was made her a symbol of his career.
I know. It's like he might need to have thought it through a bit more. Yeah.
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 But, you know.
But just as a slight diversion here, when some of my books were published in the United States, I had an American editor who was Native American. And he was named after Marlon Brando by his dad because they were so grateful to Brando for all his support. My editor in America's name was his name was Brando Skyhorse. Isn't that brilliant?
They know how to do names, don't they?
But he's now an established writer in his own right. I've looked him up on the internet. And he discovered, his first book is about how he discovered he wasn't Native American after all. His mum had made this all up just to just to avoid being another single parent Mexican immigrant mum. Anyway, you don't forget a name like Brando Skyhorse. Lovely chap. Must read one. Must actually read one of his books one of these days. I haven't spoken to him for 20 years. But so great support from celebrities like Marlon Brando, Jane Fonda and all those, and the rock band Creedence Clearwater Revival, who are a local band despite their sort of southern sort of sound. Bad Moon Rising, that's them.
I've Proud got that Mary. Going. I was just going to say, I've got a little Bad Moon Rising earworm now you mentioned that.
Yeah. Proud Mary, keep on rolling. So they organised a water barge for them. And then they spent like a fortune on this barge, which was going to mean that they wouldn't have to just collect rainwater.
And of course, called it the Clearwater.
Yes.
Clearwater. Sort of poetic.
See what you're doing there. Yeah. And they moored it along the island, and it meant they didn't have to, that gave them some long-term sort of security. There was actually a water tower on the island. They covered it in graffiti, saying lots of positive things like peace and freedom. And then there's one bit of graffiti that said, Custer had it coming.
Oh, there's always one bloke on the demo, isn't there? Just goes that little bit too far. We're trying to win mainstream opinion over here, mate. Just tone it down a bit.
Yeah,
I know what we're all thinking, but you don't have to say it right now.
Don't say it in front of the white media.
Just calm it.
Calm it down, mate. There was one activist who was at this press conference who gave his name as Arthur White Man Killer. It's like, okay, so what are you exactly are your aims and objectives, Mr. White Man Killer? So the occupation continued, I should say, you know, they had set it up so there was a school there. There's women running a school. They managed to get it accredited so children wouldn't have to retake a year of their education. Like you say, there was a Radio Free Alcatraz. They published a newsletter, and it captured the imagination of the alternative culture scene in San Francisco. But this isn't necessarily a good thing, Angela.
Yeah, because there's sort of associations, aren't there, with that scene, with the filthy hippies.
Well, the hippies turn up.
You know,
up.
Yeah, exactly. And when the hippies turn up, soda, drugs and alcohol dropouts and maybe slightly negative ways of being portrayed in the media that they could have done without.
Exactly.
Really.
I mean, apart from the fact that alcoholism was perceived as a problem in the Native American society, which it probably was actually, in the same way that it is in Aboriginal Australia, there's no sort of genetic predisposition to it. They've had over thousands and thousands of years of being used to drinking beer like the Tudors did. So they are, I think, more prone to alcoholism. So they had banned alcohol on the island. Then all the white hippies turn up and say, we got beer. And it's like, guys. I found this the most depressing thing of all, actually. It reminded me of the Bristol again. But you remember when they toppled the statue, the racist statue of the slaver in Bristol? There was a guy with white dreadlocks right at the front. And it's like, mate, get out of the way and just let the black people topple the statue of the slaver. It's not your, this isn't your show, mate.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt about these hippies. They're like, we're going to come and just like have a really chill scene on the, so cool, the Indians are taking over the island. Let's do some drugs. So this is a bit of a problem, and it created tension on the island. And it's sort of like white people taking over American Indian scene.
God, we just can't help ourselves. We can't help ourselves. But someone over there is getting some attention.
Yeah.
I'll have some of that.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election, and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So eventually the non-Indians were prohibited from staying overnight, but things had started to go wrong for the occupiers. On January...
They've been there a few months. They've been there a while. You know, this isn't all taking place over a week.
No,
we're now in January.
We're 1970 now. Richard Oakes, I said, was the leader and he was the press spokesman. But the daughter of his partner, 13-year-old Annie, and his stepdaughter, she fell to her death on the island. And that was a very tragic moment for them all. And they decided they could not, they were too sad to stay on the island, and they left. They didn't have the heart.
Yeah,
for
well,
anymore.
You would, you wouldn't, if your daughter's yeah. just died in this protest, one thing, but yeah.
By May, the government had cut off all the electrical power to the island and all the telephone service to the island. And then in June, a fire, no one knows how this fire started, but it destroyed buildings on the island, the warden's house, and there was a lighthouse on it, a federal lighthouse that was important in San Francisco Bay.
Yeah, so, for the shipping.
I mean, I should say when this first happened, this occupation, there was it went right to, you know, Nixon's office, and it was like, should we send in the sort of state troopers to, you know, get them all off with guns? And it was a peaceful occupation. The Indians didn't have guns, but there was a, there were the local sort of law enforcement like, we're going to get them off there, sir, with guns and batons and stuff. And it was the White House was going, no, just sit this one out. Let's just, you know, let's not create violent scenes on the media. We don't want that.
Yeah.
So they sort of did it this softly way of cutting off their power, stopping the food getting there, you know, and all that. But yeah. when two oil tankers crashed into each other in San Francisco Bay, the authorities were able to point to the loss of the lighthouse in the fire and say, you know, you've got to have a functioning lighthouse on Alcatraz Island. It was actually...
Although that wasn't why the oil tankers
crashed. It wasn't, but they could
use it as a...
They did. Yeah. It's actually the very first lighthouse on the whole west coast of America, that lighthouse, but and it was all burned out now. This started to turn public opinion against the occupation. People are getting a bit bored with it, to be honest, and going, oh, well, if they're not letting the lighthouse use, you know. So they're without power, without fresh water. They carried on for another year in small numbers, but diminishing public support and sympathy. And it was just there were just 15 people left on the island in 1971. And a large force of government officers just turned up with weapons, I think, and removed the 15 people from the island.
15 people aren't that hard to move,
quite,
are they?
Quite.
And, you know, they've been there for 19 months. So there's a long old stint on Alcatraz. And thousands of Native Americans have spent time on the island.
Yeah.
You know, they sort of, it wasn't the same people all the time. They would swap and change and people would come and go. But now the time on the island's over.
So, you know, although the Indians were no longer in occupation of Alcatraz and they'd not been granted their demands. But in reality, I think the occupation was about consciousness raising and agenda setting. In that sense, it had been a huge success and an inspiration to Native Americans across the whole country. Like I said, the sort of Montgomery bus boycott of Indian activism. Sort of performance art politics and hats off to them. Postscript, Richard Oakes was shot dead in 1972 when confronting a white supremacist. Oakes was unarmed and the murderer was acquitted, citing self-defense. That sounds familiar, doesn't
it? Oh, that could never happen today, could it, John? Unarmed man gets shot by a white man.
Yeah. But Nixon did officially end the termination policy. Indian reservations were saved by the raised profile of Indian grievances, brought about by Alcatraz, really.
Yeah. It feels like there should at least be a film about it, you know?
Yeah,
or maybe, John, a musical. I mean, who do we know who can write a musical?
I think a white man should get all the money for this. I think that would be fair.
Definitely should be, good point.
I have to say...
Don't write the musical, John.
As well as reading the book, I watched a whole documentary about it and had a lot of traditional Indian music in it. Now, you know, there's a big cultural gap between Europeans and in Native American culture. And I just, the stuff I listen to, I'll say, good. I like the drums, but the singing. I mean,
John, you've never been so white in your life as you are right now.
It's no ABBA, Angela. I'm just saying that. Indian music, it's no Mellow Magic.
I tweeted something the other day about being in a taxi, didn't I? Yeah. They were playing Magic FM and John replied something about how it's a bit hardcore for you.
Mellow Magic.
Don't worry,
more.
It's Mellow Magic. Yeah. You'll be fine.
If we do write a musical about it, it'll be hard. You know, people go, well, you've got to use traditional Indian music. Yeah. How are ticket sales going with that, mate? So the book I read for this, Angela, was The American Occupation of Alcatraz Island, Red Power and Self-Determination by Troy R. Johnson. Can I just read you the dedication to this?
Yeah.
This book is dedicated to my wife, Laureen, who patiently waited as I completed my PhD and the research and writing of this book. Yes, dear, it's finally done.
A bit passive.
It's a bit, it's a history of passive aggression.
Yeah. Thanks, dear.
It's finally done. Yes. But I think, you know, maybe it feels a bit different. I think I'm sure he's Native American. I'm sure it feels a bit different in his language. But it was an amazing little sort of backwater of history. But, you know, a great sort of poetic protest. We should raise a non-alcoholic drink to the Native Americans and say, well
done. For, and of course, your courage and fortitude. Struggle's not over for Native Americans. You know, there's so much going on at the moment with, you know, pipeline protests and all sorts of things going on. So, maybe we should educate ourselves a bit more.
Well, that's the purpose of this podcast, though, to try and sort of get people to go, listen to John Langella. They're the authorities on Native American history. This research took me a long time, Angela, and yes, dear, it's finally over.
And on that note, I think that's it for this week.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Do follow us on Twitter at We Are History Pod.
Yes.
Now, John, are you going to try and not release too many podcasts at once?
God, I'm sorry, everyone. It's like this.
John got a bit trigger happy with the podcast.
We did one on the release for the correct Monday, and then on Tuesday we got the edit down from Spike, our producer. So, I can set that up for next Monday. So I loaded it up onto the new interface that Acast have, and it's like, I can't navigate my way around this. So I load it up, and then I set the date. And loading it up, it was already on now. So it was like, oh my God, I can't get it. It's already being downloaded onto everyone's iPhones. Yeah, pull it back, pull it back. Stop the internet.
Can I suck it back up the internet?
Stop the internet, everyone.
Honestly, like watching my granddad trying to program a Betamax. It's wonderful. I laugh.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for forgiving me for that. But it's this one will hopefully go out on the right day. And they'll be weekly up until sort of week before Christmas, hopefully. And then we'll take another break.
And then we'll take a little Christmas break and we'll be back in the new year. But there's a couple more before that.
Excellent. So, all right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
Catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.